But we know now through the thousands of peer-reviewed journal articles that people that suffer from all sorts of chronic diseases and illnesses, both physical and mental, that heart rate variability is diminished in those individuals. I call this our stress resilience metric. It allows us to understand how much capacity we have in order to be able to deal with stress. But it could also be, in the short term, our stress management. Is our body stressed at this moment? What can we do to be able to combat that?
Olá a todos. Meu nome é Mafalda e este é o podcast Supera-se. Aqui vou falar de saúde. Seja comida, exercício físico, sono ou tudo o que te possa ajudar a ser a tua versão super. O objetivo da Supera-se é conseguir criar uma comunidade de outliers, pessoas fora do normal, pessoas que querem estar constantemente a melhorar e que não se contentem com estar bem, mas querem estar ótimas. Pessoas que não têm medo de lutar pelos objetivos e pessoas que querem ser super. Hello, I'm Mafalda. I'm a health and performance coach. Welcome to Podcast Supera-se. Today we have the pleasure of having with us Greg Elliott. Greg is an exercise psychologist, is an osteopath and an entrepreneur. He's a heart rate variability expert. He's also a wearable technology thought leader, speaker, and also a sought-after healthcare practitioner. Greg is also the founder of Health QB Technology, a health monitoring platform focusing on helping people improve their heart rate variability and also put into some actionable data where what they can find with this this measure. Welcome, Greg. It is a pleasure of having with us.
Yes, thank you very much. Excited to talk all things technology, wearable, heart rate variability, and the like. So this is, I'm excited.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this this subject because I'm a I love data, so it's a really nice way to use data on how to use this data to improve our health. So it's, this is a really nice subject for me.
Great, excited.
Yeah, I think it's important to, before diving in on how is it important, this metric, try to explain a little bit what is heart rate variability. Can you explain a little bit and deconstruct this measure?
Yeah, it's becoming obviously more and more popular with wearable products that are using this metric. And I think people have an idea somewhat of what this is, but I don't necessarily, you know, kind of understand it's big value that it can have in regards to understanding your health and well-being. So most people understand that it's associated to your heart rate, you know, 60 beats per minute, 90 beats per minute. But what heart rate variability looks at is the frequency of which each beat occurs. So, you know, me and my patient can have, you know, the same resting heart rate of 60 beats per minute, where mine varies significantly up and down. So it goes up to 70, down to 50, up to 70, down to 50, nice rhythmic pattern. And they have a more consistent metronome-like heart rate. Mm-hmm. That's of concern with me when it's more metronome-like, where it's very consistent on the second, every second. We want a variable heart rate, which is, when people first hear that, they think it's very counterintuitive because they think that we need stability in our body. Yeah. You know, health is our homeostasis, our ability to maintain a stable environment. But we know now through the thousands of peer-reviewed journal articles that people that suffer from all sorts of chronic diseases and illnesses, both physical and mental, that heart rate variability is diminished in those individuals. So we know for sure that this plays a significant role into longevity, both the health span and lifespan of individuals, as well as acute illness and sicknesses. It's a fantastic measure that's super sensitive to pick up these things.
Yeah. It's how is this metric related to stress and our ability to deal with stress?
Yeah, so the way that we kind of describe it for me, when you look at heart rate variability and you take these metrics where you start to track it over periods of time, I call this our stress resilience metric. It allows us to understand how much capacity we have in order to be able to deal with stress. So that's where I see it being extremely valuable. So how it's connected is, as I think we know that when we are stressed, our heart rate goes up, our blood pressure goes up, and all these biometrics kind of go into the survival mode where we need to be able to, you know, mobilize glucose for fuel, more short-term energy and things. And then when that stress is removed, that our heart rate decreases, blood pressure decreases. what heart rate variability actually can do is it's more sensitive to subtle changes. And I think heart rate, when you look at the metric, it's good at looking at big changes that happen over, rather than more minute, smaller day-to-day type of behaviors. And this is where I see the value of heart rate variability versus heart rate. We may see a change of one or two beats of someone's resting heart rate, where heart rate variability may be a 20, 30, 40% swing. So it's way more sensitive in that standpoint to look at the impact of our specific behaviors regarding our stress resilience. So that's where I see it. Mm-hmm. Is what I do is I try to track it over a period of time and look at our stress resilience, but it could also be in the short term, our stress management. Is our body stressed at this moment? What can we do to be able to calm back down? So those are kind of the two areas where you look at stress. I'd say stress management would be, you know, my immediate reaction that happens. Can I mitigate that over a period, you know, within the time frame? Or overall, am I doing the right things to making sure that if something does come on, I have the capacity to be able to deal with it?
So yeah, this is like the short-term response to stress and the long-term resilience to stress, let's say.
Exactly. It gives you both those metrics. And that's how primarily people utilize it. They utilize it either through a wearable like a Oura Ring or a Whoop or an Apple Watch. And they look at the nighttime or nocturnal. And that gives you kind of the stress resilience understanding. Mm-hmm. And then the other popular use is in the moment. You know, as I start to breathe and meditate and do mental imagery or journaling, what does that do to my stress response at this specific moment? Can I mitigate what I'm going through at this specific time? Is there a specific breathing cadence that works, a specific mental image that works that can be able to make sure that whatever affects me doesn't create a gigantic physiological effect?
Okay. But here, when you talk about like meditation, is more to... it's not to how to measure, but how to mitigate and try to improve the heart rate variability.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. Because there's, I mean, many different styles. You know, people just say go meditate. Well, I mean, how many types of meditation or breathing or types of journaling or mental imagery are there? There's tons and different styles, different cadence, different frequencies, all different things. So this is where heart rate variability gives you the objective feedback along with subjectively how you're feeling to say, hey, this is actually an impactful way. This specific version of what I want to be able to utilize is the best for me as an individual.
Yes. Yeah. Before diving in on how we can, let's say, improve the heart rate variability, can you tell us what is, we already talked related to heart rate variability and stress management and stress resilience. What is the other relationships that we could have between heart rate variability and health and wellness?
Yeah, there's a lot of things when you start to be able to look at various areas that could be impacted. So we can look at our emotional regulation, our emotional intelligence of things. There's a lot of research going on now of looking at our emotional intensity and emotional valence, whether it's a positive or negative experience that we're going through. Heart rate variability can give us a significant amount of information around that. There's a lot of research going into non-invasive blood glucose monitoring and how heart rate variability can play a role into helping people understand their blood sugar concentration and when things affect them in real time. Non-invasively, which is absolutely fantastic. And then it comes into, you know, a lot of the earlier research that was done in regards to the prognosis of various conditions. I can have two people that suffer from, we'll say, a heart attack. How do we know, what is their chances of reoccurrence? And how do we know if people are going to be healthier and long-lasting? Heart rate variability has actually been proven as a fantastic metric to understand that aspect of it all. So to give you an idea, it's kind of all-encompassing, but the difficulty for a lot of people, and we'll kind of get into this, is the interpretation of it all. If someone doesn't have, say, a good heart rate variability value, what do you do about it? There's a lot to be able to understand. It's not as simple as A equals B. It gives you one specific statistic, but then you dive into the person as an individual and look at not only their non-modifiable factors, but they're modifiable factors from truly a biopsychosocial context.
You were talking about that there could be several different heart rate variability. And I believe that, of course, that if we try to search on the internet, there is like a table saying that this is a good one and this is a bad one. But there is a ton of factors that can vary. And even if we have woman, same age, we could have differences between these two people. What can impact these variations in heart rate variability?
Yes, so the first thing is going to be, you know, genetically. I mean, there's certain things that, you know, we will have inherently in our bodies that we necessarily can't control.
Yeah.
And so that's one big aspect into what's going on. And yes, that's one of the things that I do a lot of consultations on, is people find what the average is. They realize they're significantly below average and what they can do to be able to improve upon it. Now, luckily is the fact that my caseload, people come to me when there's already a problem. So there's already something happening, whether it's they have fatigue, whether they have a certain illness or disease or anything of that nature. So I see a lot of people that there's already something that's abnormal from them. And so we pair that with the heart rate variability. But I always tell people that if you're feeling great, you have a lot of energy, you know, you get, you know, regular tests done, go to the doctor, everything's fine. You know, you seem to be happy, you have purpose in life, you have a good social network, and heart rate variability is a little bit lower than average. That's just maybe where you're at.
Yeah.
And that's where that you are. But what the goal is that if you're feeling absolutely fantastic, your health is great, your well-being is great from a truly a biological or physiological, mental, psychological, and social aspect, and your heart rate variability is 50% of where the average is, to me, your goal is to keep that heart rate variability where it's at. You can maintain that as high as you possibly can, you know, at that specific level, be able to mitigate the regressions that we see over age with heart rate variability. That is a gigantic win for individuals. So it really comes to pairing, and this is where, you know, I find the objective and subjective information super important. You know, data is absolutely fantastic. It does so many things, but if the person doesn't feel better, they're not happy, they don't have a lot of these things that they want to be able to keep going, it doesn't matter necessarily what the data says to them. So we have to be able to look at the subjective information and objective. So for instance, heart rate variability goes up. We have great biomarkers now from the blood and things like that, but they're still tired. They're still fatigued. They're still exhausted. It's like, okay, well, what are we missing? Right? We're working in one area, but like, how can we be able to change the subjective information, the subjective experience of this person? And so you got to be able to compare both of those things. And that's where I think fantastic practitioners do is all the information, they don't rely on one specific thing.
Yeah.
You know, as a doctor, you don't rely specifically on x-ray to tell you if there's pain or not. You have to be able to look everything into context and be able to drive that that plan for that individual based on as much information as you can possibly gather.
Yeah, because I think what you're saying is important, because from one side, people, maybe they have all the values, the objective values in correct parameters, but then they don't feel great. But then we can have the opposite. We are always comparing with the previous day, and the previous day was so-so, the next day will be so-so. But in our perception could be good, but we don't know how good we will feel if we improve this. So sometimes it's also... is if it's a subjective measure, this can lead to subjective results, of course.
Absolutely. So, yeah, as I'm saying, both of those values are super important. Yeah. People, they're purely about data, and they can tell someone's story purely on the data. I'm like, oh, well, that's only a piece of the puzzle. You have to understand the person, what their goals are, what their values are, what their upbringing was been, you know, has been like, and what their, you know, what their vision of the future is. So all these things are going to play into how you would prescribe certain things, but the data to be able to support that aspect of the plan.
Yeah. One thing is that, for example, today I have, I'm wearing OOP, and also I have the Oura Ring, but normally I look more to OOP values. And one thing that I see is that there is the trend in terms of the month or the weekly trend, and also there is the difference day to day. How can we navigate between these differences between day to day and these trends to try to understand when should we do something and when it's the normal variance day to day?
That's a fantastic question. This took me, you know, early on in my career, a lot of understanding to put into place in regards to my practice, how to best help people. That you're completely right. And you kind of look at the weight loss aspect. Yeah, I kind of compare it to that, where it's like, yes, you're going to fluctuate up and down from day to day. You may do everything absolutely right, and you're going to, you know, weigh the same. You may do, you know, some things wrong, and obviously you're going to weigh less. it's your body going through this adaptation of this change. It's again, you're changing your homeostasis, whether it's you're changing the way that you work out, the way that you eat. Like, your body's going to fluctuate. It doesn't know necessarily what to do. So you're going to get these abnormal results. But what you want to see, the trend over a period of time going that right direction, which is, again, I never take someone like, don't take every individual day as, you know, what's happening. You know, as a lower day, just some things, your body's fluctuating many different ways. But like, if you can have 5 out of 7 days being in a good value, that's absolutely fantastic. That's great. You can't change everything. So what I see is that if you look over a week and you see, you know, pretty consistent results, it means you obviously have a good amount of stress resilience, right? So if you're, I'll just throw out numbers so people have a reference, like say 60, and you're pretty much at 60 every single time, and you're kind of going through your day, that's great, right? You're adapting to your environment very well. Like, you're being able to deal with everything that's coming at you. But if you start to see these highs and these lows and these ups and these downs, right, you still have an average of 60 over that period of time, but there's something in your environment that's really impacting you, that's causing a lot of these changes and adaptations. You gotta go, well, what is that? Is that a change in my sleep? Is it dietary stuff? Is it work related? Is it family related? You start to be able to see as to what's fluctuating this stress management side of things. Again, you know, as you said, the day-to-day is more that stress management side, where you start to look at over a period of time, it's that stress resilience, kind of look at the difference between the two. But the number that's associated with this, we call the coefficient of variance, or the CV percentage. And we have, depending on how you monitor it, you want to be able to see a certain amount of variance, depending on what you want to go through, right? And it all depends on the time. If you want to be able to change things, you're going through a big training plan, you're going to stress your body, you want to see a higher coefficient of variance, where I just want to be able to get through this week and be able to try to, you know, put my head down and be just fine. You want to see a low coefficient of variance at that standpoint. Yeah. So it all depends on what you're trying to do, what you're trying to be able to accomplish. But that is, looking, understanding that concept of the trends versus the day-to-day is, it takes a little bit of time for people to zoom out a little bit. But obviously coaches like yourself and educate people to understand, like, that's, you gotta look at the big picture of things.
So the coefficient of variance, if I understood correctly, is we have our average and is our how much our day-to-day value goes far from this average, let's say.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. And typically it's about a 5 to 7 day average of a percentage. Okay. So over the 7 days, how much variance have you had over those 7 days?
Yeah. For example, and I think this question, I think, is really important, because, for example, yesterday, I know that I had, I did more physical activity than my usual. So today I saw my heart rate variability and it was low. Yep. And I know the cause of this low value, so it's okay. But if we constantly have these lows and we don't have an apparent cause, then it's the tricky part. And also sometimes, for example, alcohol is a big one, because, of course, at exercise, maybe we could see the reflections on the day after, but alcohol, we could see the reflections several days after. So alcohol, for sure, it's also one that... It's important to take care. It's always a compromise. If we want to compromise alcohol with better health and better heart rate variability, and what this improve on heart rate variability can bring us. But I think this is also an important thing, is try to understand, as you say, what is the trend. If there is a trend in weekly trend or monthly trend, if we have always a low heart rate variability on, I don't know, on Monday, for example, after the weekend, for example, understanding these trends can help us try to define what should be our direction, let's say.
Absolutely. And one thing that's super important about the alcohol aspect is one of the big eye openers for people is the awareness of what it actually does objectively. I think everyone knows that alcohol is like, it's not, you know, I know it's not good and everything like that. You know, it'll feel good the next day, but not until it's in your face to understand it. Like, do you see how not only, you know, your sleep metrics, it's not as credible as they are, but to a degree is that, you know, you don't sleep as well and your heart rate variability decreased by, you know, 40% just due to this specific thing. It's an eye opener. I've actually had a patient that was using alcohol as a coping mechanism for her fibromyalgia. Literally has stopped for over a year now because she's like, I knew alcohol was bad. I didn't know it was that bad.
Yeah. How bad? Yeah.
Right. And so now she's using other things. And because of this, resistance to alcohol, she's able to have her pain medication by 50%, right? Halved her pain medication, which is great. Because she was, short term thought it was beneficial, but not until she became super aware of what it did that she'd be able to kind of change her behavior around it.
Yeah, that is an important point because sometimes we know that something is bad, but we don't know how much is bad. And then if we don't know how much is bad, we don't know how much are we losing making that habit. And having these wearables and understanding, okay, because of course that after these wearables, we need to understand what this data represents and what can we do with this data. But having this objective measure saying us what is the impact of this specific habit, this will be a high opener to understand, okay, what if I want to compromise my next day in terms of focus, in terms of my ability to do physical workout, my ability to be with my family and whatever, because I want to drink alcohol or not. And this is like, I feel that sometimes people cannot make these changes because they don't have data. Sometimes they have the data, but they still don't want to make the changes. But I think the wearables and to understand the importance and the impact of heart rate variability is giving the data. Of course, then afterwards, people still need to decide, but it's first giving them the data.
And the big thing that I say to a lot of people is they can, if they're apprehensive of changing their behaviors, and again, it's wearable, but I mean, they're coming to us to change their health and well-being.
Yeah.
So I say, like, we see these things, you don't want to change these things. You know, you're spending your money to be able to on me to be able to help you with your health and well-being, but you're doing these sabotaging things to be able to decrease it. So, you know, there's a disconnect between what you're saying and what you're doing. So how, what is the purpose of this? What are we trying to be able to do and to have a more tough conversation with individuals if they're doing these behaviors that are counterproductive to all the work that they're trying to be able to do in other areas?
Yeah. Because we already talked a little bit about this, but we didn't dive in. Of course, that heart rate variability can give us some perception of some things in terms of stress, for example. But majority of people already did, for example, a blood sample analysis, for example. What are the additional benefits that we can have with this kind of measure, for example, the heart rate variability, against the blood analysis, for example, the simple blood analysis?
Yeah, the benefit of heart rate variability in what I typically say in a lot of my presentations is, to me, it's the most important metric for our health and longevity. And the reason why is there's many different ways is the fact that it's cost effective now to be able to get this metric. It wasn't always the case. It costs a lot of money to be able to get this type of information. But now I think Fitbit accuracy aside, but I mean, a couple hundred bucks, you can be able to get a wearable on a continuous basis to get this feedback, which is absolutely phenomenal. So one is cost effective. Two, it's continuous. I completely agree that there's maybe some genetic tests and various things that can look at things on a specific level, but you have to do them every 6-12 months? Be able to do them. You can't do blood testing or genetic testing or these DNA type of testings every single day.
Yeah.
And so you get this continuous feedback from those wearable products. So to me, there's information that can give you an idea of where to go with the plan, right? They give you the roadmap of saying, okay, here's all the routes to Rome, right?
Yeah.
We think this one is the best. So let's start going down this path. And without some sort of continuous monitoring is the value of heart rate variability. Like, you don't want to look up in a few hours and not really know what's going on and be like, okay, well, now where are we? Did we go down the right way? Did we make the right exit? Are we going to, all of a sudden you hit a roundabout, you take the wrong exit, you're going somewhere completely west rather than north? So heart rate variability gives that indication of saying, hey, that GPS of saying, yep, nope, we're on the right track. We kind of keep going. Yep, we're going the right direction. Hey, there's something here, maybe divert, you know, in between these, you know, these other important biometrics, you get an idea of intervention efficacy. Are you going in the right direction? Yeah. Are we actually making a meaningful difference, or are we going the wrong way?
Yeah, it's like it's easier to reroute if necessary, let's say. And also another thing is that blood analysis, of course, that we could have, we could take different things, different, we could analyze different things with blood analysis, but there is really high differences when we measure, for example, blood in the morning, blood in the evening. If it's a woman, depending on the time where the where we are in the menstrual cycle, and these wearables also are a good thing because normally, for example, Whoop, I don't know exactly the others, but for example, Whoop measure always in the morning during sleep. That is the time where we are not subjective to stimuli, that this is improved because of course that we are in a stress situation, maybe this is, will have an impact of on the heart rate variability. So this is also decrease this variability on the metrics, let's say.
Yeah, no, the when I first started over a decade ago in using heart rate variability, this is the time where you wake up, you put a heart rate strap on, you open your application and you take a value and it's anywhere from a minute to 5 minutes and then you press save and things like that. And the amount of complications that came with that, where people would forget, they would read their emails during the reading. I had a client that he's, you know, his routine was the fact that he would wake up, he would put on jazz music and make his coffee. Right. And he's just like, I don't want to stop that routine. It's my instant thing. Wake up and I go, okay, well, then I guess wear your heart rate strap while doing it. Right. You'll be able to sip your coffee and do it that time. So it made it really hard. So, and you can only get one sample that time. The reason why I like these wearable products is that you have a bunch of different samples, anywhere from 60 to 90 different samples, and start to look at the trend over that period of time. Mm-hmm. It's the benefit of that versus an Apple Watch as well, which will take 3, 4, 5 samples a night. And yeah, if you've seen the Aura, Whoop, BioStrap, these wearable products that show you these different data points, depends where you are in your sleep cycle, it's going to drastically change what your numbers are. So if they capture you in all sorts of ranges or in a specific, you know, cadence, it's just going to produce that value where it's going to change drastically over the period of nighttime, depending on where you are in your stage of sleep. So having all that data is super important to be able to do that. And the adherence rate for people, they don't have to wake up, open an app, it is done, right? Another thing I get is you talk about alcohol, is people like, oh, I drank last night, I know it's going to be bad today. I'm like, well, I want to see that number. Like, I want to be able to make you aware of what those choices made. But, you know, with these wearable products, it's automatically done and I get the data instantaneously.
Yeah. In terms of wearable products, I know that in your health QB, you work with people to try to help them in use this data and transform this data into actionable steps. Do you use any specific wearables? And is there any wearable that you prefer, and what is the differences between, because of course that there is several prices, several specifications. Which ones did you work already and which ones do you recommend?
Yeah, we're slowly becoming device agnostic. We didn't necessarily want to make our own wearable, and there's so many out there now, which are becoming more accessible and more cost effective and everything. So the ones, I think the biggest issue that I find with people is not necessarily the kind of wearable. It's like, do they want to wear a ring?
Yeah.
Or do they want to wear a band? Or do they want some sort of watch that has functionality? So it comes more to the person of like, is again, you know, you can go on what your favorite is and that can change from time to time. But people are like, well, I don't want to wear a band on my wrist. I don't have to wear a watch, or, you know, I don't want to wear a ring. I want something more here because if I lift weights, or I just don't like wearing rings, or so it really depends on that. And so if you will go through the hierarchy, kind of the big three ones, you have a ring based wearable, you have a wrist based wearable, and then you have a smartwatch.
Yeah.
That's kind of where I'm typically have my big three. So the priorities of that one. Aura is obviously the one that's been around the longest. I like them because they, you know, show a lot of the raw data. They be able to, you know, with the practitioner side of things, there's not a lot of algorithms that they have. So it's fantastic. It allows me to action a lot of that. And they produce a lot of their data. They want to be able to show the scientific validity of what they do. So they've got a lot of research papers out there, which is great.
Yeah.
From a wrist-based wearable, the one that I like the most is actually a smaller company that is out of Austin, Texas now. They're primarily a business-to-business or enterprise. They don't necessarily do direct-to-consumer.
Okay.
But it's a company called Biostrap. And the reason why I like them is, again, they show the raw data. And they give you all the RR intervals that they collect. And so you get a lot of their back-end information, which is absolutely fantastic. And they just released their newer device, which is, you know, now the 10-day battery life that you get from a continuous basis. So the battery life is there, which is absolutely fantastic. And then from the smartwatches, the best one that's out there, if you do want something that's more functionality, to me is going to be Garmin. Mm-hmm. You know, they acquired a company in 2020 called Firstbeat that really increased their understanding of this data capture and data accuracy. And so they're probably the furthest along of all the smartwatches. Again, I would suggest, you know, more the wearables that don't have an interface that you can have higher quality sensors in it, because the interfaces, you know, they take battery. And so having the higher powered, higher quality sensors in those devices, that doesn't make it feasible really to happen. So, but Garmin, I'd say, is probably the closest out of all of them to be there. So those are kind of my big three that I typically suggest.
Okay. And you... Queria fazer uma pausa neste vídeo para te falar do meu programa Super, o meu programa de Health and Performance Coach. São 6 sessões individuais ao longo de 10 semanas. Vamos definir quem tu queres ser, quais os teus objetivos e o que é que tens que fazer para lá chegar. Vamos perceber como é que podes melhorar o teu bem-estar físico, mental, emocional e espiritual para alcançares a tua melhor versão. Se tiver alguma dúvida, podes consultar superuse.pt/produtos. Podes ainda enviar e-mail para mafala.superuse@gmail.com ou então enviar uma mensagem para as redes sociais.
I think because Aura and Whoop, I know, the other two, I don't know. Do you think they are, because of course that is two steps. That is to know the data and to take action with this data. You know that they are these three examples that you mentioned. They are, let's say, easy to understand and to make some actionable actions.
Yeah, well, I hate to say it, and this is the reason why HealthQB was created, is the fact that I don't think any of them are very good, because, you know, they'll go to the point of, hey, your numbers are good, rest today.
Yeah.
Okay, well, what is that? Why? What does it necessarily... What do I have to be able to do? And being a practitioner in the, you know, in the trenches to see kind of the limitations of this, you know, and I ask this to doctors sometimes when they're, you know, they like to use wearables and things. I'm like, okay, well, someone comes to you and they say, you know, their REM sleep's bad on their wearable product. What do you do? And it's hard because it's like, well, why is the REM sleep bad? You got to be able to investigate as to that, because the sleep quality of an individual could be sleep hygiene related. It could be diet related.
Yeah.
It could be exercise related. It could be stress management related. It could be, and this is because of COVID, social interactions, whether at work or at home, or lack of social connections. So all of those things will impact our sleep quality. So to me, when someone says, hey, my sleep quality is bad, I want to be able to improve it, I go, okay, well, I need to know these other areas. And this is where HealthQB came in, because we're kind of going, okay, well, there's so many other factors that we need in health. Can we have a way to look at these equally? Can we have an assessment of someone's nutrition, exercise, their emotional regulation, their mind-body connection or their interception, their relationships and their social connect? We have a standardized model to look at this and be like, okay, well, where are we not meeting the needs of our being? Comparatively, right? Because if you're doing, you know, I have this sometimes with consultations where people are doing 99% of sleep hygiene and exercise components, 95% of nutritional stuff, right? And they want to be able to get that from 95 to 100, where they're in a super high stress job. They have difficult relationships at home with their kids. They're not happy. They don't have a goal or vision in life. They feel lost. Like, well, that's where our focus needs to be. I don't necessarily care about, you know, improving the things we're already doing so much better in. Let's explore. And sometimes that was a difficult conversation to have. So, you know, as we see the value of data, can I have some sort of representation that shows, hey, this area of the pie, you're doing phenomenal, but here we're severely diminished and this is how it's related to health. And that's what came in regards to the product, is showing those discrepancies to people right in their face to say, hey, there's areas of your health and well-being that aren't being addressed that we need to put our attention to that are drastically going to improve your both objective but also subjective health and well-being.
Yeah, it's having this more holistic approach, let's say, and looking, even if this heart rate variability, okay, physical exercise for sure have an impact, nutrition for sure, and sleep, as you were saying, also have an impact, but there is much more. And having this holistic approach, it's sometimes can solve problems that are hidden if we just focus on these three big nutrition, sleep, and physical exercise.
Yeah, I mean, that's going to help a vast majority of people, right? Be able to look at those and dial those in. Absolutely. There's a study that came out with the fact of looking at, this is the American population, but looking at the fact that people had, what are their health habits like? Looking at physical activity, looking at body composition, looking at nutritional intake, and the fact if they were smoking or not. And of those four things that they looked at the American population, well, how much percentage of people are actually doing those four things? Very basic things.
Yeah.
Would you take a guess?
If they are checking the four boxes.
Yeah, so they're having a relatively nutritious diet. They're doing a minimum amount of physical activity. They have a relatively normal body composition, and they don't smoke.
I would say between 10 and 15%.
2.7.
Okay.
Crazy. And what was shocking to me more is that 11% of the people didn't meet any of those criteria, meaning that they smoked. They didn't get minimum amount of physical activity. They weren't having a nutritious diet, and they had a poor body composition. So four times as many people, right? And so when I'm talking to individuals, you're going to make a drastic impact for people if you just be able to focus on those basis of things, right? Doing the basis. If you can get those at 80% of where they should be, you're doing absolutely phenomenal. But some people that I see, they're doing 90% of those things. They're so dialed in with genetic testing and blood work and their diet and their exercise and that. But it's like, okay, well, there's other areas of health and well-being too.
Yeah, I think when people are, for example, coming to you already wearing these wearables and already knowing about heart rate variability, they are already doing these basics.
Yep.
But if we look to the general population, as you were saying, this 2.5%, 2.5, right?
2.7%.
Of course, that is a different sample of people. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. So exactly right. The people that you see that are on these wearables that won't be able to prove their metrics, they're typically already, making a significant impact into those areas. So usually it's something that you'd be able to dig a little bit deeper into. You know, you look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and you look at the base of that needs aspect. It's like, okay, that's the physical health, the nutrition, the sleep, they're doing great, but there's many other pillars that go on top of that.
Yeah. One thing that we were talking, so of course there is several specific variations, individual variations for heart rate variability. And of course, if there is specific reasons for these variations, there will be specific ways to improve these variations. Can you mention some examples on how to try to understand, okay, this variation, this could be a way to improve, or some examples that you have?
Totally. Yeah, I'll do the big hitters.
Yeah.
So the big things that I've seen move heart rate variability the most in that stuff, and they usually come back to the five areas of health and well-being, which is, and some of them are a little more generalized, but you look at nutrition, sleep, exercise, stress management acutely, mm-hmm. And connection with people. So what are the big hitters in those areas, right? So what are the actionable pieces of that? Because it's great to say, hey, manage stress, just breathe and change your mindset. And it's like, well, okay, well, how do I actually do it? What are the things that we can possibly action as of right now, right? So for the exercise portion of it all, the best thing that we know is aerobic capacity, meaning our VO2 max, mm-hmm. our ability to be able to do activity for long durations. So this is where the zone two that everyone's been talking about now is a gigantic factor into that. And you're looking about that 180 minutes of zone two, which is just going out for some people, it could be a brisk walk in regards to that stuff, or just sitting on a bike and kind of pedaling over that period of time. I've seen that make the most significant impacts in the general population. The big hitters from that standpoint, adding that stuff in, even people that are just purely doing high intensity training, we include that in, it makes drastic changes to not only heart rate variability, but I would also say that the peaks and valleys, as we talked about, right? That coefficient of variance, that coefficient of variance starts to be able to mitigate a lot more. And from day to day, it's more of a consistent value. So to me, that's the big thing.
Yeah. Just to interrupt you, and before you move to the second point, one thing that I notice here is that because people are so stressed and they can only have like 30 minutes of exercise or 20 minutes of exercise per day, they think that it's better to push ourselves to 200% because we only have 20 minutes. And if we don't sweat, it doesn't count. And this point that you mentioned is important because, for example, even for me, that I consider myself a really active person, it's really hard for me to train in this zone too. Even when I go for a run, I have really difficult maintaining this on zone two because I want this rush of running faster, and it's important to understand the benefits that we can have training in this zone two.
Absolutely, the education piece around as to why, especially for people, is going to be big.
Yeah.
Number two, we'll talk about nutrition now. Yeah. And this is obviously very nuanced. You know, I always say is there's nothing more dogmatic in health and well-being than nutrition. People have these things where you have to do this or you have to do that and these type of things. And it is so individualized. It's so nuanced for each individual where things work and why things don't work. And so from a general standpoint is what I typically say is we have to understand what foods cause your body inflammation.
Yeah.
Then let's be able to eliminate those as much as possible, right? There's many ways to be able to look at that. There's some great elimination diets and various things to be able to figure out kind of what's going on. There's DNA testing, which has its own pros and cons, but there's blood work from that, be able to look at various things you're deficient in, things we need to be able to. So to me, it's about having a low amount of inflammation. Now, it's not saying that there's specific inflammatory foods because I can have something and you can have something and we can have a completely different immune response to those foods. Yeah. So it's highly individualized. There's no low inflammatory diet. So this is a more nuanced perspective. It takes a little more time to be able to dive into it. But I'd say anything you can do to be able to understand what foods cause your body inflammation is a gigantic win. And there's a lot of ways to be able to look at how to be able to figure that out.
Yeah.
Sleep. Usually it's two. Sleep for me, the biggest thing that I've found is looking at your circadian rhythm and optimizing that. So to me, it's being able to fall asleep and wake up at the same time. Try to keep that cadence, right? Making sure it's dark at night, make sure it's light when you wake up. And so it's optimizing that side of things. That simple framer for people makes a drastic change in people's sleep quality because it has set that nice natural rhythm of the hormonal responses. To be able to have a nice circadian rhythm. So that's a super, super key element.
Yeah. One thing about sleep that I was seeing a podcast last week. I think it was from Uberman. I'm not sure. But he was talking about what is more important between the hours of sleep or the interval of sleep. So if we need to choose between, for example, sleeping always at the same time or and sleeping, for example, 6 hours, or sleeping in different times and sleeping 8 hours, the normal 8 hours, seven and a half, 8 hours. What is better? Do you have any specific thoughts about this?
It's, to me, it's going to be the specific time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that what came about of it?
Yeah.
I completely agree. Everything I've read, it's that. Absolutely.
I think, of course, for me, it also depends on how much difference are we talking. If we are talking between 8 and 6 or between 8 and 4 hours. Okay. If we are talking about this, is maybe it's better the 8 hours. But if we are talking between 6 and 8, my research also points to the interval of the sleep.
Completely.
Yeah.
That's always my, and that's the thing is you get people to set up a specific time in regards to fall asleep, wake up. They're probably not going to choose 4 hours. So it's also benefit when you have that conversation, like, hey, well, pick a time, like you pick your bedtime, pick your wake time. They're going to pick something within that 7 to 8 range typically. Yeah. Right. So that's a big one.
Yeah, this is the most important for sleep, because, for example, there is also some discussion about the chronotypes. And
yes,
do you think this has a big impact also? Or because, of course, that chronotypes in ideal world, we could choose our we could exactly sleep on our chronotype. But of course, that we have jobs and not always we can choose. At what hours are we working?
No, and that's the thing. Exactly. You get to choose when you want to go to sleep.
Yeah.
Right. So to me, that's completely fine to be able to do that, whether you want to do it at 9 o'clock or 1 o'clock, whatever necessarily it is. It's like, but you'll be able to say that that's your time and don't be like, I know I should go to bed earlier. It's like, you don't have to go to bed when you want to be able to go to bed, but you know that it works and fits in with you. But set that time, whatever necessarily that time is.
Yeah. And one final point about sleep before we move to the fourth one is that really important to avoid this sleep interval is for the week and for the weekend.
Yeah.
So we don't want the weekend jet lag.
No.
Yeah.
No, that's not good either. Yeah, the people, as soon as like the Wednesday, Thursday hits, they're like, oh, they really struggle at that point. You see that. That once they get into it, usually Wednesday it hits Thursday and Friday, it's like people are struggling. That Thursday is always a lull for people that typically sleep more on the weekends, for sure. Number four is going to be the stress management side of things. Mm-hmm. And the quote that I love about this side is Dr. Hans Selye, who came up with the word stress. He was a Canadian endocrinologist that he came up with this term at McGill University in Montreal. And he said about stress, it's not stress that kills us. It's our reaction to it.
Yeah, totally.
And so around stress side of things, it's our emotional regulation around it. How do we proceed? You and I could go through this same stressor. Like we lose a loved one. But how we deal with it is going to be drastically different in how it impacts us. And if we can mitigate that as much as possible and frame it in a positive way to understand our emotions, go through it and experience it, but put things in perspective, that is a big key of our stress management response, right? So people talk about stress response. What do we do? It's that piece, that understanding that the emotional regulation piece is a big, big piece for people.
Yeah, I totally agree. Because as you were saying, even if me and you pass through a similar situation, we will respond in different ways. And there is a book that is called Peak Performance that... he has like a formula that says that growth equals stress plus rest. So stress is not bad. It's just our way that we perceive stress. And there is also some studies that say that if our perception of stress changes for the better, the results of that situation will improve, because it's a big way how we perceive that stress. If we perceive stress as a bad thing, then we will have a worst we will deal with the situation in a worst way. If we perceive it as a good way, or not exactly grow, but a way that we can grow, then our reply to the same situation will be different.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a big piece for people to learn. If they can understand, they can have that agency over their, their health and well-being by this emotional control, emotional regulation. It's big. And the last big one, I think it's becoming more and more evident, is obviously our social connections and relationships. You know, understand that I think the Surgeon General from the US came out in 2022, so last year, with a gigantic report. But understanding the impacts of loneliness on people. And I think he equated it to people that classify themselves as lonely. It's the impact of your health is equivalent to 15 cigarettes per day.
Okay.
Right. So crazy what it can possibly do. And the story that comes to my mind when we talk about this is I had a patient that I saw soon after COVID was happening. So it was months of obviously not seeing anybody and not having these connections. And she started to develop this like weird shoulder pain that never happened before, the years of seeing her and just talking to her a little bit more. And one thing that always stuck in my head was the fact she goes, well, I just don't remember the last time someone gave me a hug. Right. And so that type of like, she was missing that type of connection in her life. And when things started opening up and things go better, that was, I mean, how many years ago now? And over 3 years, and has never come back, that shoulder pain. Yeah. And so what it can possibly do for people in understanding from the social support standpoint, I think there's two components from an action standpoint that you got to make sure that you have. Is there's the actual social support, which is friends, right? Be able to go out, have a good time, you know, talk about people that's just an ear to listen to. Just to be able to talk back and forth. Then there's something called instrumental support, which is understanding that you have to have someone out there that you can take advice from.
Okay.
When you have problems and be able to rely on them. Because you have friends that are just great to have a good time, disconnect, talk about your problems. Oh, that sucks. Oh, that's not good. And not necessarily good advice, but just have that ear to listen to be able to have that connection with some individual. And then there's the other type of individual. Yeah. Could be the same person. Could be two different people, could be multiple different people, but have that person that you can go to that you respect, that has a lot of life experience that you go to, whether that's a parent, whether that's an uncle, whoever it may be, that you can go to with any problem and have that advice to kind of be able to put you in the right path and right direction. So looking at connections, you start to divide into those big two different patterns of social support, that friendship versus the instrumental support.
Yeah, I think that is a really important point, because sometimes we think that our friends need to be the funny and the people that we are going out and we are always laughing together, but there is the opposite side. We need also someone with who we can talk about deep things, the more meaningful stuff. And as you were saying, as you call the instrumental connections. And I think this is a really important point, that we don't need, of course, that is important to have the funny friend, but it's also important to have the other friend. Or if we find in the same person, it's also okay. But to have these two types of social connections, and I think this is a really important point.
Absolutely. Yeah. So those typically are the five. And then within those five, there's some actionable aspects for people within those. So those are the ones that I typically see the big hitters that not only improve heart rate variability, but our stress resilience and health and well-being as well.
Yeah. Thank you. Another question. In terms of scientific research, what are the last studies that you saw that supports this importance of heart rate variability in terms of a valuable metric, not only for health, but also for performance?
Yeah, I think, well, we'll talk about health to start, but I think one of the biggest things that is providing a lot of value to, not only clinically, I think research is starting to look at this as well, as we call it the functional illnesses, the illnesses that don't have a diagnosis, objective diagnosis to it. Right. So you talk about the fibromyalgias, the anxieties, PTSDs, depressions, these type of areas. I think there's a lot of understanding of how this can play a significant role for people that, again, have these kind of normal markers that don't necessarily have a marker to indicate of like, hey, we got to be able to improve this if we're on the right track, or we can be able to understand that. I've seen a lot of research around the functional illnesses side of things, which is super fantastic. from the performance standpoint, I think we're getting to understanding. I had a good conversation with my friend Don Moxley, who's was at Ohio State University. He's now at Longevity Labs, and he does a lot of understanding around heart rate variability and its application. He did it in sports performance, and now he's doing the general population. But he understands the state of flow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you talk about that of like, you know, how do we get kind of gather some information around heart rate variability, and can we get better understanding of this flow state that we need to be able to optimally achieve this balance of the sympathetic and parasympathetic, and be able to get that to be able to perform at our peak. I think that's a really cool approach that's looking at it, and to agree of it's more this, I'd say, the mindset and subjective nature of our being, mm-hmm. which is around emotional understanding and intelligence and regulating those and be able to performance at that standpoint. It's more of kind of a cue performance that could be, you can understand is that, you know, with a given task, are we going to perform well with this task or not? Give understanding of how can we quantify that as much as possible. Yeah. So that's where I see a big amount of research going towards.
In terms of, because flow states are really a subject that are really interesting also, what is the relation between improving this heart rate variability and the and entering flow states or staying in flow states?
Yeah, that's one of the things is the theory right now is they're kind of speculating is the fact that when certain things happen during a task,
mm-hmm.
right? Whether you go to a question or a part of a conversation that you're not as familiar or uncomfortable with, that you see a more controlled response than an uncontrolled response,
mm-hmm.
right? In the presence of saying subjectively that I was you know, not feeling the best during that specific moment or whatever it may be, that you have that ability to say, hey, I don't get these highs and these lows and these swings up and down and back and forth. It's kind of, you're staying in a nice specific cadence where you're maintaining a lot of that homeostasis to be able to go. So that's kind of the what they're trying to be able to look at now of can they be able to, you know, when things are thrown at them, whether they're doing a test and a noise happens, does that completely throw them off?
Yeah.
Of what's going on, and do we see that fluctuation where they're now more in the sympathetically dominant state and their reactions are way different in that standpoint? Can we be able to quantify that? And one of the other things that we see with physical performance that we found,
mm-hmm.
is that it's not necessarily a high or low variability on a day that's going to give you an indication of performance. It's actually the coefficient of variance.
Okay, yeah.
So if we have more of a consistent heart rate variability leading up to the match, leading up to the event, that we see indicative of better performance physically in that, mm-hmm. standpoint. So there's that component of it as well. So it's the consistency of maintaining homeostasis leading to the event, and then be able to maintain any homeostasis during the event as well, are kind of two big indications of again, it's not going to be, you know, perfect. But maybe more often than not, if we can get those two components together, people could probably be in more flow states than not.
Yeah, because in flow state, so I think this could also be related to the stress part. Because in flow states, we need to have slightly above our comfort zone.
Yep.
So we need to be, I'd say... we need to have autonomy to solve the problem. We need to have, need to be a little bit higher of our perceived capabilities, let's say. So I think this could also be related to our stress perception, because if this is the above our capabilities, but because we don't know how to deal with stress, we perceive as this, then we'll, yep. be higher. We'll be difficult to maintain, to enter this flow state and to maintain us in this flow state.
Exactly. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. And so now we enter a little bit in terms of heart rate variability and performance. How do you, with the, in your clients, I don't know if you have more in terms that have, which you work in terms of performance or more in terms of health and wellness, of course that is related, but more focus on the performance. But in terms of performance, what do you try to target with this client to, and how do you use heart rate variability to improve their performance?
Yeah, so the big piece of heart rate variability is optimizing recovery strategies.
Yeah.
Right, so that's where I find the biggest piece dealing with high performance athletes, where I fit into this.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, I'm not in program design or, you know, making sure that people peak physically for various events. I try to be able to say, hey, that, you know, that it is what it is. You have your coaches that deal with that. Where I fit into this is making sure that we're optimizing recovery strategies. You know, for instance, I've had clients and patients that from a high performance standpoint where doing contrast or cold body immersion
mm-hmm.
was absolutely terrible for them. It was impeding their recovery status more than it was helping, where vice versa, where it was like a game changer for some individual.
Yeah.
So this is where these protocols of again, you know, these specific diets or these specific recovery habits, it's like, you don't know until you start to be able to measure certain things.
Yeah.
And so that's where I find the performance of heart rate variability connection is the fact that we can optimize recovery strategies for these individuals yeah. and be able to mitigate these effects, these stressful events that, you know, go above and beyond what are typically normally physically capable. So people will be able to wake up the next day, the next week, the next month, be able to, you know, continuously perform at the high level.
Yeah, makes sense. So it's basically, again, to use heart rate variability to how to use this data to make into actionable steps, and specifically on performance, the impact is the highest impact will be on recovery, so they can continue training and increase their performance. Do you have thank you for accepting being here with me. I would like to ask you if you want to share any project. We already talked a little bit about HealthQB, but if you want to talk a little bit more and to present this project, and also how can people can find you?
Yeah, so HealthQB is again, it's we take in HRV and wearable information for people and be able to provide some actions of what people do. We prioritize lifestyle modifications for individuals of saying, hey, is right now focus on my physical activity or my interception? Do I need to focus on my purpose in life more than my nutrition? So we prioritize those specific areas for individuals and give them a roadmap of how to be able to address that. I just kind of launched a new personal website, so gregelliott.ca, which I'm going to start to be able to release some of these, you know, ebooks and various mm-hmm. videos and courses and kind of compile everything onto there so people will be able to find up-to-date information about wearables and heart rate variability and everything that standpoint. So that's probably the best place to get in touch with me is there.
Thank you. I will share both your personal Instagram and your personal website, and also HealthQB Instagram and website to
Great.
Our listeners. Again, thank you. It was a pleasure having you with us today. I bet our listeners will love our conversation and will learn a lot, and speak to you soon.
Yes, thank you so much, and thank you for all you do. I know podcasting is a lot of work, but you're great. You're sending out great information from everything that I've seen to all your listeners. So thank you very much for all you do.
Yeah, thank you.